From KCRW, I'm Bob Carlson, and this is Unfictional. Unfictional is a program of stories, personal documentaries, and radio movies. And a long time ago in the 1980s, I was just starting school at Emerson College in Boston. I was new to the dorms, and I was in the communal television room, which was down in the basement, about to watch the first Red Sox game of the season. Well, it just so happened that there was another group of guys that had just finished watching the NCAA basketball finals on the TV. And as they're leaving, one of the guys says to his friend, "Baseball, that's a white man's game." As I said, I was new to the dorms, so I wasn't going to say anything. They just left. But inside my head, I thought it was the most ridiculous thing I'd ever heard. Had these guys never heard of Ricky Henderson, Dwight Gooden, Reggie Jackson, for God's sakes? All men who happened to be playing at that moment in time. But as it turns out, the guy in my dorm had already seen a reality that I hadn't caught up to yet.
Baseball was a lot blacker back then. It was like a quarter black.
This is writer Donnell Alexander, and he also remembers a time when a quarter of all major league players were African American, instead of the 8% or so now. Donnell grew up loving baseball, like a lot of American kids, but he had his own reasons.
My mother was a Jehovah's Witness, so we didn't salute the flag. The 4th of July didn't really have any meaning for me, and baseball was the only thing that made me feel like an American. Hey, I'm part of something, part of the fabric. So I grew up in Sandusky, Ohio, a town that sounds more foul than it actually was. It's a small town on Lake Erie. You know, my baseball memory, a lot of it actually is tied up in the fact that I didn't have a father, and I have vivid memories of living in this crappy apartment and playing in this overgrown grass. I remember throwing the ball in the air to myself for hours, and I would narrate my play like I was Herb Score, the great Cleveland Indians baseball announcer.
The 1970s and 80s were sort of a golden age for African-American baseball players.
Hank Aaron was kind of seeding, and there was a new bunch of heroes kind of coming in.
It was a couple of decades after Jackie Robinson, and most major league players didn't feel the need to lay low anymore. These guys were individuals who didn't care what you thought, and they were celebrated for it.
Well, we lived at my grandparents' house. My mother and sister and I lived at my grandparents' house for a spell, and they would get Ebony magazine at the house. The magazine would show up every spring that had all of the black players from the major league rosters. And I would go through it, and I knew all of their faces. So I knew what Doc Ellis looked like. Ron LaFleur, you know, who played for the Detroit Tigers and had been in prison. And my father had been in prison, so I could identify with these players.
It's more likely that black players these days come from countries like the Dominican Republic. And Donnell Alexander isn't in Sandusky anymore. He's a divorced father of two sons. And when they were boys, Donnell had a dream that he might like to coach them in baseball. From KCRW, it's Unfictional. And on this episode, The Green Goblins.
So I've got two sons. One is Forrest Bell, after Albert Bell of the Cleveland Indians, Alexander. And Wyatt Jamal. And we spent a lot of time playing catch, talking baseball. Having a catch with Dad was something I didn't get to do. Forrest had that forever. I always wanted to coach baseball. I talked to my son about it a lot when he was little. Well, one day you're going to play in Little League, and I'll be your manager. I'll be the coach, just like on TV. And then I became a sports writer. Barry Bonds had this book proposal out there, arguably the greatest player in baseball history, but Barry backed out of the deal. So, you know, it's like a $250,000 windfall goes away, and I'm trying to adjust, trying to deal with this loss of income that's more than substantial. There are these points in life where you lose your confidence. I had a lot of upheaval, not just upheaval, I got divorced. And so I moved out of the house. You know, things got worse. My mom died. I got sued. My book tanked. All these things happened at once. I was couch surfing, and I got my crap together, mostly because I'd met this amazing woman who was a West Sider. And we moved in together. It was not my ideal scenario to live west of La Cienega, because I really needed to be around my kids. I was so far away, it seemed important to make good on my promise to coach him in Little League. I thought if I did well with the Little League thing, everything else would come into place. I called it a comeback.
Good job. Right here, this one.
This is the South Pasadena Little League.
Catches and throws.
The commissioner is the chief of police. It's just that much part of the town.
Be ready. Over the top, man.
Forrest was 9 years old, and the kids in my league were 9 years old to 12 years old. Wyatt was in T-ball because Wyatt was 4 years old. The playing field was in Arroyo Seco Park, just incredibly lush and gorgeous. And that's about 15 minutes north of downtown, 10 minutes away from Dodger Stadium. The refreshment stand is a big duty. All the parents have to do their turn there. You know, the parking lot fills with cars. It's an event. It's a happening, especially on Saturdays when all the diamonds are working at the same time. You never knew so many people were playing baseball. But South Pasadena isn't really my kind of town. South Pasadena is is antiseptic. It has a great, like, diversity. There are a lot of Asian kids and a lot of Latinos to go with all the white people. Not a lot of black people in South Pasadena. I never really felt a part of it. The first thing I had to do was draft. It was intense. The draft was in one of the coach's houses in a really nice part of South Pasadena. 10 dads, they've got their notebooks and folders. I didn't know that there was years and years of research happening before that. And the guys, the dads who were there, they had the numbers. They knew who was good. They knew who was peaking. I had to draft a dozen or so kids. The first rule is every dad gets his own kid. You're not going to compete against your son. And Forrest was a good player. He was a big kid, so he always had strength on his side. He knew how to throw, knew how to hit. Huli was this kid, small, but he was super, super charismatic. There was Darius, a kid I knew from around the cul-de-sac. My sons played with him, but the one thing I knew about him, aside from the fact that he had blazing speed, is that he had no experience as an athlete. He was going to be a project. There was this kid, Luke, I remember drafting in the later rounds. He wasn't especially, I don't know, he wasn't that talented, let's face it. He's the kid who's going to be the catcher because he's overweight, not because he has a great arm. But he was affable, you know, people seemed to like him, so I had him on the team. Lastly, there was Isaiah. And Isaiah was incredibly good. He was the tiniest kid, and he threw harder than me, I swear, man. But he was overlooked because none of the dads wanted to deal with Isaiah's dad. He was coiled. He was a ball of energy and intense, you know, and he was living out his dreams through his son. He was a very involved, baseball-mad dad. I started asking around, and I saw that most of the kids on the other team were 11 and 10, whereas mine were 9, and I had a couple 10-year-olds. I picked a lot of players who I thought had a style about them. I liked the cut of their jib, but I drafted poorly. I didn't realize that age difference is huge at this level. The difference between a 9-year-old and 11-year-old in skill set is enormous. I picked really good players. I just picked them at the wrong stage in their development. We had to figure out what we were going to be called. I was really into this rap group called Little Brother at the time. And because we were so much smaller than the other guys, I said, well, we're going to call ourselves the Little Brothers. And Isaiah's dad flipped out. That was the first real Isaiah's dad flip out before we even got started playing. He's like, oh, that's terrible for their confidence. Everyone's going to look at them as these losers, these little brothers. So Green Goblins, that's what we were called. We got the Green Goblin name because we ended up with these green jerseys. I think there was a Spider-Man movie out with Green Goblin as the antagonist, and the kids went with that.
Let's hear from you guys. Season starts now.
It was opening day. It was a big day. There were team pictures. There was the national anthem. Isaiah was our starting pitcher. You know, we played well. We didn't make a ton of errors. It was one of those games where Isaiah, being an amazing pitcher, kept the score low. We lost, but it wasn't in terrible fashion. And then we won the second one. I thought we were going to be a 500 team, meaning a team that won as many games as it lost. I can live with that. And then I think it was the third game, we lost by the mercy rule. If a team is down by more than 10 runs, 5 innings into the game, they make it a wrap. They just call it off. It's there for preservation of dignity. Unlike football or basketball, the clock cannot save you. You have to get those 27 outs in Major League Baseball, 21 outs in Little League. If you can't get them out, you're just in deep trouble. I mean, we lost 20-5. It was really painful to watch. I realized that we were going to have a lot of work in front of us, and I started scheduling regular outings to the batting cages. The coaching strategy was get better fast. It was like herding cats. If I had got 4 guys going well, I had 5 more who were just a mess and 3 more on the bench who were making a lot of noise, you know? I felt like I wasn't going to be able to put a presentable product out on the field. So I got some help.
I didn't want to do it. The time, do you know how much time that took?
I know, because I was the coach. Yes, I know. You had to do a lot.
That was very time consuming.
I invited Darius to be a coach, mostly because of his son. And he's an older black guy, 6'3", 250, just a big, strong guy. I kind of took to him as someone who could offer some wisdom.
The boy loved it.
My name is Darius Lee Dudley II. We lost our first game, and I started crying.
There would be times when he would be affected, maybe even more affected than other ball players.
I was a real crybaby.
But it was good for him to go through that, get a little dirt on his soul, if you know what I'm saying, so that he could experience what losing is like, so that he can go after what winning is like. We're black. We've got to instill that. You got to work hard and do as much as you can to be a freaking winner, because the world is going to stamp loser on your forehead.
My team was very brown. And aside from my sons who are biracial, I think like we had 6 or 7 Mexican kids. There were certainly no other black coaches in the league, you know?
We got the black team.
No, we
did not. Yes, we did. We're going to kick all the white boys and put them over here, and then we're going to give these 2 guys the black kid.
Yeah, and then we were losing on top of it. And after that deflating loss by the 10-run rule, we lost the next one. And the game after that. And the game after that. My Green Goblins lost 17 straight games. I felt helpless. I felt helpless not for the kids, but really selfishly for myself. Like, how do I get out of this? But the kids were having a great time.
It was weird. Did you think it was weird how they kept having fun? They just would.
They're children.
They would not have a bad time. I mean, were you ever embarrassed?
No. Why? I was outside with my children. What's not to like? Except it was taking too much of my dadgum time.
Forrest and Wyatt didn't make a big deal about the losing. I actually don't think it bothered them at all. One of my favorite stories. There was this game where we had just run out of any options for people who could get it over the plate. So I turned to my son Forrest because I know what his arm's like. I said, can you get us out of this inning? He goes, oh yeah, Dad, I can do that. So he goes out there and he throws this pitch called the Ephus pitch. E-E-P-H-U-S. A trick pitch that for lots of reasons has not survived. Went out with the granny free throws. He threw it like a rainbow. He threw it high. And the idea was for the ball to come down across the letters of a player's uniform on their chest. It was so tantalizing, you could not resist swinging at it. But if you swung at it, you were likely to miss it or just pound it into the dirt. Forrest gets out there and he throws the Ephus pitch. And one of the dads says, are you kidding me? You know, a dad on our team saying that to kids.
amazing thing, though, is Forrest got, he got us out of the inning with no more runs scored. The thing is, he wasn't really screaming at Forrest. He was screaming at me. Why are you letting this happen? I was on trial, you know.
They definitely wanted to win. Winning was important. Winning was the American way. Winning was steak and applesauce. You know? And losing was a pile of dog poo.
What I remember most about going to see the Cleveland Indians is that you could chase a foul ball or a home run and it would stop rolling before you got it. You know, there was just not a lot of people at the games, but I was a diehard Indians fan. Through my childhood, they won nothing. They were the worst team in the American League. They had no hope. They just lost. I took that to heart. I totally wanted to win with the Green Goblins. It was definitely a return to that kind of sense of being a loser. And it didn't feel as good this time.
Simple as that.
I wanted to do better. It occurred to me that I was not as sharp as other managers there. Before I'd taken on the job of being manager or coach of the Green Goblins, I had committed to finishing a book about Dr. Dre. And the book was about the Chronic, that era. And I was around people who had access to the real Chronic. Now, I never showed up at a Little League game, Stone, not by any stretch of the imagination. But I did many late nights researching my subject. Did I seem a little stoned to you?
That's just your nature. You walk through life a little stoned, whether you are or not.
I kind of interrogate myself about how I could have done better, and I've wondered if I was sharper, would I have been a better coach?
I didn't feel that. I felt you were just Donnell. Just finished.
Okay. Being around these dads who seem to know their way around the league, the kids, and maybe even the game better than me, it made me incredibly self-conscious, and I probably tried too hard, you know? I was over-managing because I was self-conscious.
You would raise your voice inappropriately, and you you even did the stomping, the tantrum thing. It's only a game, and I approached you the same way I approach the kids. It's only a game. They're learning fundamentals. They'll be on winning teams. This is not the end of their career.
Isaiah's dad had had enough. He felt like his kid was a star, and maybe rightfully so. Every time one of our players, you know, let a ball go under his glove and then roll to the fence and guy scores all the way from first base, that just killed him. It killed him in a way that never killed me. And he felt like our loser ways were rubbing off on his star son.
One of the interesting things about being a dad, what do you pass on? You can't just pass on good manners and respect. You've also got to pass on, get your muscle on, get out there, and get it the frick done. And if it's not done well, that's okay. You give it your best shot. Baseball, any sport, is a question of giving it your best shot at the time, because you might be on the black team.
I had a crappy car, a Honda Civic from maybe 84. Darius sold it to me for $150. It wasn't that dependable, you know, but I'd never thought it was just going to die. The day it died happened to be the day of a game. And, you know, I was leaving 2 hours early, as I usually did, so I'd get there and set up. And the car wouldn't start. So I had to get on the bus. Darius, I think, knew that he would be the guy in charge, but we didn't have any equipment, which is kind of humiliating. I got on the number 33 bus on Venice Boulevard with a bunch of helmets, a bag full of bats and balls and the catcher's equipment, just lugging it. That bus ride was the longest bus ride because I just know that I'm not getting there anywhere close on time. I do believe it was rush hour. By the time I got to South Pasadena, I knew that they were already in the third inning.
there wasn't a bus stop by this baseball field, so I'm lugging this equipment from the bus stop. I remember that walk being hot and humiliating and seemingly never ending. I was never going to get to the field. By the time I got there, I think there was an inning left to play, and we were losing, of course. All those parents, all those dads who thought I was just a loser and unserious about baseball. It was just a low point. I can't even put it into a particular category. There's this tradition of the after-game snack. They sat on the bleachers eating these granola bars and juice boxes in silence and not very reverent. I just remember just the lifelessness of the moment. You know, when you're at a great little league game, there's all this buzz in the crowd, and this was just a lifeless moment. Everybody gets in the playoffs in Little League. Everyone gets in. It's a play-in game, actually, that we had. It was the two worst teams in the league, and the winner would advance to the playoffs. Isaiah's relationship to the team was so tenuous, his dad was saying, I'm not even going to put him out there anymore. I was expecting to go into the playoffs with just this group of underachievers. Yeah. So I threw this practice, a special practice, but I sat them aside afterwards, and I gave them this pep talk, the closest thing to a Newt Rockne pep talk that I have in me. I turned off all the lights on Burke Field except for the one over the dugout, and I had them all get into the light. I told the individual kids what their play had been like all year. Like, I told Luke, the catcher, your mom, when she sees you out there in right field and the ball comes to you, she makes a beeline for the refreshment stand because she doesn't want to see what's going to happen out there. And you can do better than that. The look on Luke's face when I told him was like, I'm going to get my crap together. And I went through player by player and told them how they needed to improve their game. I feel like that kind of sunk in because they were really good the next game. We didn't have Isaiah. We were thinking we were going to have to go into this game without our star player. But Isaiah showed up maybe 40 minutes before we started. Comebacks are great because they bring up hope. Comebacks are just thrilling. They're the purest form of thrill. You feel like anything can happen after you've experienced a comeback. Isaiah Cardenas on the mound was unhittable. He struck out batter after batter. We're into the third inning, and we scored some runs. The other team had scored nothing. It was a perfect game. They didn't even have a base runner. So we were up. Isaiah pitched the whole game. It was a big game for Darius.
It was Isaiah's no-hit game.
Late in the game, we had one fly ball.
One of their players hit it into the outfield, and the ball came sailing towards me.
You know, I'm thinking the worst.
At that point, training was kicking in.
He's got his glove up just like I showed him, and he looks a lot better than he did at the start of the year. If this had been April when we were first starting to play, that ball's going over his head, and the runner's going to score inside the park home run.
That's the beauty of training, is that once you repeat something so many times, it becomes second nature. I saw a fly ball. I went to go catch a fly ball. I caught the fly ball. There's not much to it.
He made the catch that clinched the game, and the kids celebrated as if they had won all season.
I learned how to stop crying after everything.
Baseball is a constant series of adjustments. That's all it is. It's an adage that I've picked up, that Barry Bonds. And Darius made those adjustments. You know, this is the happy ending part of it. But, you know,
We got into the playoffs, and we played the number one team, and we gave them a really hard time. My guys hit, Isaiah pitches. They beat us maybe 7-5. The score eludes me at this late date, but it was close right until the end. I think the other manager came up and said, you know, we lucked out. And the parents, I'm not going to say I completely won their respect, but I gave them a good memory.
And really, that's the best thing you can give a parent, a great memory. That's writer Donnell Alexander.
It'll be 10 years ago this spring that I coached the Green Goblins.
And recently we talked to Donnell over Skype. He's in Portland now. And he still has a cinematic memory of that last game and of his former rival.
Isaiah's dad, picking him up in the air, it was like out of a film. When I wanted to be the coach of my son's Little League team, I had that kind of glory moment in mind.
Being a father is not always what you have in mind. Your perfect idea can go wrong in a dozen ways, and then the best parts come during what seem like the worst moments. And that's what being a father is: great memories, bad memories, and a series of adjustments.
And had to move up here to Portland. Wyatt Forrest and I, we're all like texting buddies. You know, we're cool, but I've missed a lot of their lives.
Donnell's younger son, Wyatt, is back in South Pasadena playing high school baseball now. Forrest is attending school in Northern California, but he's not playing baseball. That story came from Donnell Alexander, Portland-based writer whose writing and commentary has been featured by Time and Al Jazeera, among other places. The piece was produced by Nick White, with editing from me, Bob Carlson, and Carla Green. The baseball sounds in that story were recorded by Eric Drachman earlier this year at the very same South Pasadena Little League where Donnell coached back in 2007. The recordings are part of KCRW's Sounds LA, a collection of sonic IDs from around Los Angeles. You can find a link to that and some really, really great photos at our website. It's at kcrw.com/unfictional, where you can also find the full archive of all our past episodes. I'm Bob Carlson, producer of Unfictional. The editor is Nick White. The associate producer is Carla Green. I invite you to podcast this show on iTunes, follow the show on Twitter at Unfictional, or like us on Facebook. And I hope you'll join me next time for Unfictional from KCRW.com.
It's the top of the ninth. Josh Gissom is at the plate. The bases are loaded. It's a 3-2 count. And here's the pitch.
It was a known fact, Jack. With the weather so hot, who could play like any day? The greatest and the best, like the Satchel Brother Page. Long time and little bump in the Hall of Fame. Like Josh and Buck, be alert, duck. Everybody was down for being peanuts. Foxes in the Sunday's best, the brightest dress.
And on deck, said G.
Not baseball today, true. It's mostly non-racial. But back in the days, it was all segregated. The whites had the majors, and then the blacks had the Negro League. They both had great talent, but then us blacks have no history of all our great players. The team's in the ballpark, but we're here to shed light. Restore the glory they haven't got, black baseball. They paved the way with players like Dandy, the Devil, and Dave. Black baseball, they paved the way with players like Dandy, the Devil, and Dave. Black baseball, they paved the way with players like Dandy, the Devil, and Dave.